Hello, everyone, and thanks for hanging out with us for the Behind the Numbers Weekly Listen, an e-marketer podcast made possible by Basis Technologies. This is the Friday show that reviews the most... No way. Media news stories of the week. I'm your host, Marcus Johnson. In today's show, how the Omicron variant could change things.
What we're seeing, that shift to online shopping. I can think of things like more contactless payments and just, you know, from the business side, flexibility, whether it's with the service itself or with payments and things like that.
The threat of churn.
There are also lots of other options for entertainment outside of streaming. So if we think about where consumers are spending their time and money, it might not be on streaming in 2022, but it'll certainly be somewhere else.
What people click on.
I think anyone who spends time around the web or on social media knows that there are clickbait headlines all over the place still. So I think that they're still very relevant.
Sharing information with brands, how to solve working from home annoyances, and what's it like in the coldest place on earth? Join me for this episode. We have three people. Let's meet them. We start with one of our principal analysts who heads up our retail and e-commerce practice. It's Susie David-Kenyon.
Hey, everyone.
Hey, Susie. Thanks for hanging out. We're also joined by Peter Varley, who is one of our senior forecasting analysts.
Hey, Marcus.
And finally, we're joined by one of our directors of forecasting. It's Oscar Orozco.
Hey, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
Hey, fella. So, gang, thanks for hanging out. What do we have in store for you today? Well, story of the week, how Omicron, that variant, is changing things. We'll explore. We then move to the game of the week, where our contestants, Susie, Oscar, and Peter, give us the best takeaways they possibly can from each of the four stories to try and win the championship belt. We move to working from somewhere after that, which is the third segment where we talk about what it's like to work from somewhere. And finally, we have dinner party data for you. You know that one. I won't explain it. So let's start with the story of the week, how Omicron could change things. New coronavirus cases in the US are up from their 70,000 per day average in October and November to 120,000 a day, according to the New York Times. What does that mean exactly? What do those numbers even mean? At its worst, last January, the US was registering around 250,000 cases per day. So if that time back then was 10 out of 10 bad, we're now, according to cases, we'd now be 5 out of 10 bad. But in October and November, things were 3 out of 10 bad. So they're worse than they were just a few months ago, but they're half what they were at the height of this pandemic in terms of cases. The spike in cases in recent weeks has been partly attributed to Omicron, the latest variant. But what do we expect the impacts of Omicron to be on consumer behavior? Folks, any initial reactions to how you think Omicron's going to change things? I mean, it's still very, very new in the grand scheme of things, but any thoughts on how it could shift behavior?
It looks like, according to the two studies, one from Civic Science and the other from Morning Consult, that consumers or people's peak comfortability was over the summer of 2021. But since then, comfortability doing a wide range of things from shopping, eating out, going out in public to traveling, it's all been much lower than during the summertime. So I'm not sure when, you know, people will get back to high levels of comfortability, but with the Delta variant, now the Omicron variant, it seems like it's going to be a long winter and, you know, people are probably going to stay inside, do less public activities and be a little bit more careful.
Yeah, it does seem like they're already, Americans were already bracing themselves for a winter COVID wave. CoreSite research showed that before the discovery of Omicron, 63% of people were concerned about a winter wave. After Omicron's discovery, that share of folks just went up by 4 points. So people were already concerned and now they're a little bit more concerned, it seems. Susie, you cover retail for us. Any effects there that you can see happening?
Yeah, I feel like I actually read the studies a little bit differently than you in that I found that one study was very dramatic and it was like a 4-point shift, as you just said now, and they were calling it tanked and it's really dramatically sinking, and really 4 points is not that high of a shift. And the other one, the Morning Consult, was a little bit more positive. And I think that's what we're seeing in the news, right? It's so mixed depending on who you ask and what headlines you read. You have a different perspective. I would say we're seeing a lot of apathy. People are bracing themselves every couple of months for something bad to happen. And so they're just learning how to deal with it. And regardless of whichever study we look at, it seems that in-store shopping still seems to be relatively, people are relatively comfortable doing. But I think it's probably because we're left with the 10 to 12 days before Christmas time. And so now is the time where stores are really important for gift giving because online orders won't make it to you.
Right.
I agree, actually, with Susie. I think both studies were a bit contradictory in a way. I think the headline was a bit misleading. You know, one thing that we've, and on the forecasting team, Peter, you know, you've as well gotten questions about, you know, Delta and going back, you know, months now, very similar questions about what kind of impact we would see on consumer behavior there. Ultimately, it didn't really change what we had been seeing since, obviously, the onset of the pandemic in 2020 and early 2020. You know, from what we know so far, of course, things can change. And I do think the public health situation will, as we were just saying, will get worse through the winter. So it will have some sort of impact, especially as people crowding inside together. But with what I was saying with Delta, we didn't see much of a shift, right? We had our finger on the pulse there. Ultimately, it didn't really result in any big adjustments. So I would say it really is business as usual, I would think, for businesses and from consumers. Susie just mentioned it, but what we're seeing, that shift to online shopping, I can think of things like more contactless payments and just, you know, from the business side, flexibility, whether it's with the service itself or with payments and things like that. So that's kind of how I'm looking at it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I think we should remember that there's a difference between consumer confidence, whether people are confident that they should be able to spend more money. And so it's not the COVID virus that is impacting that. It's inflation and price increases mm-hmm. and supply chain issues. And then mm-hmm. there's changes in consumer behavior. So we mm-hmm. are seeing that, but we're not seeing necessarily a net negative when it comes to spending. We're just seeing shifts happen.
Absolutely. And I would just add, looking at certain industries, right, the travel industry, food and beverage, things like that. These are industries that, you know, unfortunately remain very much impacted. And it remains to be the case, I would say. I think there was one chart there, I believe it was from Morning Consult, that just showed, you know, it's a bit better than at the worst, as you said, Marcus, maybe 5 out of 10, not 10 out of 10 here. But, you know, there is no end in sight there for certain industries and, you know, all the difficulties they've been having.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of what you guys are saying is that we've kind of been in this world, and even though it's a new variant and the unknown is, you know, scaring some folks, they're still relatively comfortable being in this world, that given that we've been in it for a while. The Economist devised a normalcy index to track how behavior has changed and continues to change because of the pandemic. And the index compares 8 different indicators: city, public transport, traffic congestion, the number of flights, box office revenues, retail foot traffic, things like that. And 100 equals normal, so pre-pandemic. Today, according to that index, America is at 80. It was at 50 at the start of 2021. So it has made great progress. Omicron hasn't really had a chance to show up in the numbers yet. I think that index runs till the end of October. But sporting attendance, time outside, and retail traffic are all well above 90. Cinema going is the only metric below 70. So those others are close to what you would call quote unquote normal pre-pandemic. Some other positives as well. US COVID cases in the past week have flattened despite going up the previous weeks before that. Also, the number of folks who are losing their life to this in October, 1,600 a day. November, 1,200 a day on average. And we're seeing similar numbers in December. So cases have gone up, death rates have remained flat. The same's true in the UK. The same's true in Canada and the world average as well. The problem is that both numbers are still not going downwards, and that the number of folks being hospitalized in the US has been climbing since November. But there are a large number of Americans vaccinated. According to the New York Times, 6 out of 10 Americans fully vaccinated. 7 out of 10 have had at least one shot. For older folks, the worst affected, 9 out of 10 fully vaccinated, and nearly all have had at least one shot. In terms of things, how things could change, just to wrap up the lead story here, what's concerning is that from mid-November to the end of November, the share of folks saying that they would be comfortable doing certain activities has fallen, according to Civic Science. Even by a few points, the share of people comfortable shopping went from 73 to 69 in about those 10 days or so towards the end of November. Eating out, working in an office fell by 4 points. Traveling, movie going, attending public events also falling. We'll see if that continues. One of the trends, the Office of National Statistics in the UK, ONS, was saying is that British households spending more on goods, less on services. So that has been one effect of the pandemic, at least so far. That's what we've got time for the story of the week. Time now for the game of the week. But first, a quick word from our sponsor, Basis Technologies. Today's podcast is made possible by Basis Technologies. Basis Technologies has created a digital advertising platform that connects people, automates processes, and unifies channels, bringing together programmatic, site direct, search, social, and CTV in one single interface. And through the power of automation, Basis enabled brands, agencies, and publishers to build and operate a healthy, secure, efficient, and profitable advertising organization. Ready to take control of your advertising? Just go to basis.net today. That's www.basis.net. Basis Technologies, the future of advertising has arrived. All right, folks, we are back. It's time now for the game of the week. Today's game, What's the Point? Where we read out four stories and have Susie, Oscar, and Peter tell us their main takeaway of the story. Okay answers get 1 point, good answers get two. And the way Americans feel about breakfast tacos, answers that give you that feeling, it gets you 3 points. Each person gets 20 seconds to answer before they hear this. There it is. Whoever has the most points wins, gets the last word. Nobody ever wants, but I give it to people anyway. We start with Peter. Tide says no to the Super Bowl. Tide has decided not to run the 2022 Super Bowl commercial, breaking a four-year streak, if you can call 4 years a streak, for the P&G brand, notes Ad Age. Insider intelligence analyst Daniel Konstantinovich thinks the absence of Tide from the Super Bowl is significant, both for the company and the sporting event, though he does note that other major brands are sticking around, with Intuit TurboTax securing its ninth consecutive Super Bowl spot. Broadcaster NBC Universal said in September there were only a few advertising spots left for the event per ad week. Peter, Tide saying no to the Super Bowl this year, what's the point?
So in my opinion, I don't think that this is actually a big deal. I mean, you kind of alluded to it. 4 years running isn't exactly a huge streak. And this is just one brand that's not advertising during the Super Bowl. Last year, Budweiser, Coke, nor Pepsi advertised, you know, three brands that have done a ton of Super Bowl advertising in their history. So, you know, I think another angle is that CPG brands have done really, really well since the pandemic. So maybe it's just that they don't need to spend that much money anymore. I don't think that it means that these ad spots are any less relevant.
Susie, what's the point?
I agree 100%. I think there's no point. This is overblown. It doesn't really matter. They've already sold all the ad space anyways. And the particular article you were referring to didn't talk about it, but Tide does plenty of stuff with NFL and other sports players to begin with. And apparently they're looking at activations on the ground. So I really just think that it's Tide is looking for new ways to engage with customers. And that's it. No big deal.
Oscar.
Agreed with my colleagues here. I'd add one last thing. CMO of P&G, Mark Pritchard, it has been very vocal about the inefficiencies and gray areas of digital advertising. He's essentially a kind of a controversial guy. He waves the big budget he has in publishers' faces. And, you know, I think he's trying something new, switching things up. It's not a big deal to me. I think it's just what P&G does.
We move to our second round. We start with Susie, the threat of churn. A Deloitte report predicts the streaming world will face a 30% churn rate in 2022 and 150 million cancellations as users unsubscribe en masse from a multitude of services, writes insider intelligence analyst Daniel Konstantinovich. Daniel thinks that viewers are becoming less keen to pay for multiple services, pointing to a June Adweek Morning Consult poll that found that while nearly 40% of US adults subscribed to more streaming services during the pandemic, over 60% said they would not add another in the next year. Susie, the threat of churn, what's the point?
So again, I think this is one of the things we talk about a lot. You know, it's easy to cancel. There are so many more options in terms of streaming and people follow the next title. And I think one of the things we don't talk about often enough is there are also lots of other options for entertainment outside of streaming. So if we think about where consumers are spending their time and money, it might not be on streaming in 2022, but it'll certainly be somewhere else.
Oscar.
I think the number Deloitte talks about, which is a 30% churn rate in 2022, seems way too high for me. I'd love to know where they're getting this information from or where this estimate's coming from. I'm not quite sure. It seems too high. I mean, the facts are there are tons of services, you know, but we haven't seen indications that people are less willing to pay for additional services. Also, keep in mind, a lot of this shift to, you know, SVOD, AVOD services comes from pay TV, and we continue to see that churn there. And there are still big numbers with pay TV. So I'm just much more bullish on this industry. I do think we'll see consolidations potentially in the future, thinking of that Warner Media Discovery merger, perhaps. But, that headline seems just too exaggerated for me.
Pisa.
Yeah, 30% churn is really high. I do think that there will be a number of people who decide that they don't want to pay for a service, you know, a couple months after their free trial ends, because there's so many of these streaming platforms are new and they had really attractive deals that when you sign up, you'd get a bunch of months free. So I wouldn't be surprised if there was higher churn next year. Hopefully things are better with the pandemic, so less time at home. So yeah, there's a lot of services that are really great and people will stick with, but there's certainly going to be a lot of changing.
Round three. What people click on, we start with Oscar. Content marketing platform BuzzSumo has analyzed some 100 million article headlines. How is that possible? To find out what garners attention online and what gets ignored, writes Inc.com's Jessica Stillman. The analysis found that back in 2017, emotional words in headlines drove the most engagement on Facebook, as well as quizzes and tribal headlines that played on group identity, like mums with twins. So what headlines are winning the war for attention now? Ms. Stillman points out that it's shorter ones, ones with numbers, certain three-word phrases like need to know, rankings, newness, surprise, and actionable insights. Hyperbole still works, and time-centric elements in headlines like this year or in X seconds were highly effective as well. Oscar, what people click on, what's the point?
Yeah, I mean, I was laughing when they mentioned that it's likely your crazy aunt who's driving the clicks on these things. it's true. I am almost sad to admit that I sometimes fall for it as well and click. But, yeah. You know, we know this type of marketing is huge. The clicky bait articles. I mean, for me, it was interesting. I mean, it all boils down to human nature. Why we, for example, play the lottery or love to gamble, I think as these headlines need to provide, obviously, some sort of entertainment, but, you know, push that imagination, our innate curiosity. And, you know, ultimately, as it happens with lotteries and gambling, we end up disappointed. And that's what happens with a lot of this content, right? It ends up not being what we thought it would be.
Pisa.
Yeah, I think headlines are more important than ever because there's just such a flood of information online and, you know, various places that we go to get news and we go to get social updates, etc. So having a catchy headline is super, super important. And I actually really disagree with one of the lines in the article that mentioned the almost complete disappearance of clickbait hits. I think anyone who spends time around the web or on social media knows that there are clickbait headlines all over the place still. So I think that they're still very relevant.
Susie.
So I love this article because I think I read it in a little bit of a different way in terms of headlines are the mirror to our society. And as times change, the headlines also change. I think I didn't get that they were talking about they're never going to be clickbait articles ever again, but just that what gets you to click on the article has changed. And if you think about it now, it's all about inclusivity. So of course, if you have a headline about twins, that's, I don't know what the percentage of twin population is, but it's very low, right? So who's going to click on that now when we're all one big happy family? So I think headlines changing is around society and norms changing, and it makes sense that that's reflective.
Move to our final round. Sharing information with brands. We start with Peter. A recent survey of 9,000 folks across the US, the UK, France, Germany, Australia, Singapore, and India from mobile app experience company Airship found a few things. Number one, 78% of people ignore or delete emails from brands they've subscribed to half the time or more. Number two, personalized offers based on behaviors is one of the least likely motivators for folks to opt in to smartphone communications. But information not personalized to my needs is one of the main reasons for opting out. Number three, 52% of US people will share their mobile number for text messages. 37% will share it for phone calls. Peter, sharing information with brands, what's the point?
Well, the top response shows why email marketing and communication has really surged back and become so important because it's, you know, a pretty easy way for brands to get in touch with consumers because consumers are very willing to give that information popping in an email address to a box somewhere is very easy, and people don't feel like they're giving away a ton of private information. And just want to mention quickly that at the bottom, only 36% say they're comfortable sharing what they browsed across unrelated websites and apps. And that is really the core around Apple's latest privacy update. So very, very relevant there.
And just for context, top of the list of what you're willing to share was emails, was what Peter's referring to as this resurgence for email marketing. And then at the bottom of the list was sharing your social information. Susie.
So I think for a retailer or a brand, it's important to think through about personal data and that value exchange. If I'm going to give you my data as a consumer, I'm expecting something in return. And for the most part, it's make my life easier or make something cheaper or help me remember to do something faster, better. And I think that's what we're seeing. Consumers are willing to give away their information. So like think about texting, right? That's faster, easier. So of course I'm going to give it to you if you're going to help me. There's a lot going on in life. I need help. I know. Can you erase that? Like my,
I feel like my
brother's going to be like, really, Susie, there's a lot going in life. You are 1% of the population and this is what you're saying.
Oh. Yeah, no, we'll get some t-shirts made with that on it. There's a lot going on.
I love it.
I need some help. So Oscar, what you got?
Wah, wah, wah.
All I would add is, you know, also consumers just, I feel like they, you know, they feel misunderstood. They don't want to be pigeonholed, right? And I think that ultimately means, of course, personalization is the way to go, but it's not a science. It's an art. And, you know, you don't want to give too much. It's more about quality over quantity as well. So, you know, brands have to keep that in mind. It's not easy, but ultimately, you know, it's their goal to try to provide as much personalized content as possible. That will be the way to reach the glory land, I think.
That's what we've got time for the game of the week. This week's winner, a drum roll. Peter is this week's winner of the game of the week.
I thought it was going
to
be Susie.
Congratulations to
I'm
Peter.
So no. Rude.
Come on, Oscar. Wow. Did you really? Did you really think that?
No faith,
Peter, Oscar. Congratulations.
No, I believe in you. But I thought...
You thought all my lobbying was going to work? It never does.
No. Peter, championship belt, congratulations. And also 30 seconds. What do you want to tell us?
Thanks, Marcus. Sorry for not giving enough context. I kind of zone out sometimes when you read the intro to the game of the week because I'm really preparing myself for what the answer is going to be. So I appreciate the assist that you just gave me.
No trouble.
Russell Westbrook and AD. But I don't know what to say other than I have some very, very great competitors here today. And everyone go get your booster shot if you can. It's been 6 months since your second vaccine. And we'll try to make it through this holiday.
Love it.
Well, indeed. That's all we've got time for the game of the week. It's time now for Working From Somewhere. This is part of the show where we talk about what it's like to work from somewhere. We'll probably do this another week, maybe one more week. Basically through the end of the year, and then we're done. We're coming up with a new segment. Got some ideas for you guys, so stay tuned for a brand new segment on the Weekly Listen next
year. Can it be another game?
No. Do you want to lose two, Susie?
Yes,
I feel like that would be devastating
win.
To the self-confidence. Okay, you want to double your chances?
Yes.
Okay, that's what you mean.
So rude.
It won't be, but I'll think about it. I'll pretend to think about it. Anyway, working from somewhere, working from home has all sorts of annoyances. Here's how I solved them. Writes Dr. Alexandra Samuel, technology researcher, Wall Street Journal contributor, and co-author of Remote Inc., How to Thrive at Work, Wherever You Are. Slow Wi-Fi, tied to my desk, I lose track of time, I keep eating, it doesn't have to be this way, she says. And after over 20 years of remote work, and even longer as a diehard tech geek, she's built up a repertoire of gadgets and tricks that take the edge off some of the little quality of life frustrations that can ruin the joys of remote work. Here are some of them. First, she talks about if you're tied to your desk, there are no more hallway chats, walking to meetings, things like that. Make it easier to relocate in your own space. Get a laptop docking station so you don't have to plug everything back in when you move. That's one suggestion. The other one was my Wi-Fi is slow and people might be like, just upgrade it. But there's some other things you can do. You can replace your router every few years. Apparently they have a shelf life, which I didn't realize. Use Wi-Fi extenders and your router's got a quality of service feature can give priority to the Wi-Fi connections on the adults' computers in the house. So if people are trying to stream things, they're at the back of the line and priority is given to the computers from the adults. And then another one was missing collaboration. She says that she uses a giant screen. She's not talking about a 28-inch monitor. Her living room now features a projector and a 100-inch movie screen. That's a bit much. But I think the point's well taken that if you're going to be at home for a long time, why not try to get as much real estate as you possibly can and get your company to pay for it? There's a bunch of other things in here, folks. What jumped out to you?
I thought it was so funny that she has a safe for snacks. Like, do we really think she does that? Or it's just for the story?
Is it like a self-control thing?
The context here is that she says to stop herself from snacking all day, she locks the snacks in the safe. And then because they're hard to get to, she's less likely to go and grab them.
Yeah, I mean, what I think is there are some things that are maybe a bit too quirky and potentially not for everybody. I do think, you know, maybe some of this is due to control issues that Dr. Alexander Samuels might have. But, you know, ultimately, there are some good ideas in there. And I think more of where, you know, the need for this comes from, you know, the mention of missing people, being tied to the desk, being tethered to the email, all of that is something we can relate to. But I do think it can be much more simple than that, right? I think, what it comes down to is making sure you have time for lunch, taking time for breathers, you know, having an appropriate, you know, setup with a chair, and ultimately making sure you sign off at a very, you know, reasonable time every day. And that's probably all you need. But I don't know. What else do you guys think? Do we need more than that?
Well, I'm looking at a couple of things that make me question whether her employer is really setting her up for success, because it sounds like she's got to share a whole lot of her supplies. And maybe they go missing and, you know, slow Wi-Fi. Sounds like these are things that your employer should help you out with. You know, these are very solvable problems.
I think she's a freelancer and that's why all her hacks are weird.
I thought they were quite useful.
I do agree with the lunch club though. And I was with an old friend a friend I've known for a while. And we were just talking about how we miss that supportive network, or like just, you know, we went out to a restaurant bar and instead of sitting at the bar like we would have before, I was like, please give us the table the furthest away from any other human so that we minimize our risk of exposure, right? And so I do think that virtual connections like Lunch Club might be a good idea if you need interaction but are a little bit worried about in real life.
So, yeah, what Susie's referring to there is the Lunch Club, which is a networking roulette that sets folks up on virtual networking dates with other people that they might find interesting. I know, I thought some of these were really quite smart. And another one she says about stealing supplies is allocating mini storage area, using a label maker so you can find things, you know, kind of coming to terms with the fact that you're going to probably be in that space for a long period of time. As she says about having the slide open camera cover, something that you can slide over the camera when you're not on video chat and make sure no one's watching. She talks about being tethered to email, setting up a mail rule in your email client that forwards emails only from important people. Another such suggestion. My biggest takeaway here was that you need to audit your situation. You need to like really audit it. And I think that you may think you've got it figured out, but taking a good hard look at what can make your life a lot better can really help. My dad, when I went home to my parents' house last holidays and was working from home, he was trying to stare at some tiny laptop screen. So I bought him a much bigger second screen and he's able to sit back and see things a lot clearer, get him a desk lamp. There's very small things like she mentions. They may seem like they're not that important, but taking, you know, 10, 15, you know, real good minutes to sit there and check out your setup and see how you can improve things, I think is well worth it. And I thought some of her suggestions were good, even if my colleagues feel like they were
all terrible.
I did think
the time tracker was a good idea because I don't think we realize how much time we zap doing random things that are not work related and then just how much longer we work because in the middle of the day we're doing other random things that are important to do, but still.
Yeah. There's some good stuff in there. Anyway, that's all we've got time for working from somewhere. It's time now for dinner party data. This is part of the show where we tell you the most interesting thing we've recently learned. And we start with Peter. He won this week's Game of the Week. Peter, what have you recently learned?
So to commemorate the season 3 finale of Succession, I've got 6 little known facts about Succession that I just learned about the other day.
So for context, Succession is?
Succession is a show on HBO about a really powerful media family. And it's called Succession because the main premise of the show is who will take over the family business once the CEO is no longer. And it's great. Everyone should go watch it. Really, really fun and horrifying. And it's on HBO, HBO Max.
Okay.
Yeah. So sorry if people haven't watched the show, but maybe this will get them interested. Slash, I think a lot of people probably do watch the show. But number one is Jeremy Strong, who plays the lead actor, originally auditioned for the role of Roman. Again, that will fall totally flat if you don't watch the show. Does anyone have any idea here? Oscar or Susie, do you guys?
Yeah, I love Oscar the show. Yeah, I think he could have played it. He's a great actor, but weird to picture that.
You can't picture it going back, though. You know, it's like it just makes too much sense as it is. Kieran Culkin was supposed to audition for Greg on Succession.
Would not have worked.
The show would have flopped.
Victoria's losing her mind. Just for folks who can't see Victoria, she's agreeing with these things.
The Succession cast did their first read through on Election Day 2016, which is kind of ironic because they're kind of an evil empire in a lot of ways. Why is that ironic? I don't know. The Succession production uses wealth consultants. The show likes to dramatize opulence and wealth and turn it into a bit of humor and a bit of, oh my God, they're ridiculous. Succession relies heavily on improvisations. I guess they have actors who are good enough that they can just improvise the scenes and make it feel very organic and natural. And I'll cap it at 5 of 10 because I thought those were the best ones. And for anyone who doesn't know Succession, they won't care anymore anyway. So yeah, great show. Everyone should check it out.
Very good. Let's go Oscar.
All right, awesome. I'm going to follow up talking about Succession. Great show. Agreed with talking about the Renaissance. A little bit boring, but you know, I love history. Let's jump into it. It is based off of a show I've been watching on Netflix called Medici the Magnificent. It's about the Renaissance era. To be honest, it's not particularly good. Actually, I'd probably go as far as not recommending it unless you're into the era of history, but I'm fascinated with that period. Maybe there's a few listeners that are into it. You know, the art, Florence and Venice and, you know, Leonardo da Vinci, all of that, the Age of Discovery. It is very fascinating. So I've heard about weird aspects of that period. So I dug into a little bit more for this. So a couple of facts for you guys. Men were not considered to be mature enough for marriage until they were at least 30 because they would hang out in gangs and they were called Giovannis. And they pretty much roamed around and were just delinquents. You know, they could do it until they were 30, of course. But women, they were expected to be married by 16 or 17, of course.
What do you mean men just roamed around?
That's all they did.
Pack animals. Just
pretty much. Like wolves. Like wolves. Right. Apparently. Maybe not all of them, but many of them.
Probably most of them.
I would hope
not so. Not mature enough until 30? Yeah, some of this still holds true. Yeah.
It might have been. Might have been. A couple more things disparaging to women, a terrible time, but, you know, just realities of that era, unfortunately. Women were discouraged from playing wind instruments because they were told it made their faces look unattractive. So they were encouraged to play string instruments instead. Bizarre. Also, women were not allowed to stand in front of windows. Why? They would inflame the carnal desires of men walking below and take those men away from God. So a lot of rules and regulations for women, but of course men, you know, could do whatever they wanted. Last fact, very interesting, right? I thought this was interesting. The fanciest room in the palazzo, in the palace, was everyone's bedroom. So people would invite people over to their bedroom and, you know, have them over there instead of what we normally do now, which is living room, dining room. So I thought that was kind of interesting. Renaissance, interesting era.
Yeah. Huh. If you get invited to someone's bedroom now, like the hell are we doing in here? Where's the living room? although, to be honest with you, most New York apartments, it's just the room. It's just the whole
just
one room.
Big room.
Yep. And so that was still true. This is my kitchen. This is where I shower. Very good. Very good indeed. Susie, what you got?
So as we approach the last days to Christmas, I wanted to talk about the PNC, which is a financial firm's study that they do every year around the cost of, if you all know that song, the 12 Days of Christmas and the gifts. What is the cost of all of those gifts in one core? I don't know if anybody knows.
Oh, I think I... What? $1 million. I read this the other day.
Ugh. So inflation today in October was up 6.2, the greatest inflation rate in 30 years. And
56 million. Sorry, I'm getting carried away.
All PNC... Right. says that the Christmas price index, it even has a special name, is up 5.7 versus 2019. They claimed that they couldn't do it for 2020 because it was too hard to measure the price of some of the items on that list. Today, one core is at $41,000. To put that in perspective, NRF thinks that people are going to spend on average $648 for all the gifts that they're buying over the holiday season. So the Christmas price index is the lap of luxury. And if you take all of the repetition in the song, that gets you up to $180,000, I'm rounding, for all the different gifts. Can you guys guess which is the most expensive? The Seven Swans a Swinging. Swimming. The Seven Swans of Swimming.
I would not have guessed that.
At $13,000 estimated price, but with zero increase from 2019. And the six geese a-laying are only $660, but...
You need to get me some.
That's up 57%.
Some geese?
Yeah. Six
what do you mean you need to get yourself some geese? What are you talking about?
No, he said we have to get
it's
him
low
some.
Value. Why would you want that one?
No, even lower it's are the turtle doves. But the cheapest in that grouping is the milkmaids.
But they're people. How do you put a value on, like, lords are leaping?
It must
how
be
do you
on
put
the
value?
On the milk. Oh no, I know the answer to the leaping people. It's the Philharmonica. One of the dance companies has given the value of that.
Oh, how much it would
almost,
cost you to get 10
I guess
lords
to rent
to
them
leap?
Or not rent
okay.
them, but borrow them.
Awesome. Oh, so it's the cost of the service.
Okay.
Or apparently birds are more expensive this year than 2 years ago.
Oscar, why do you want geese?
I don't know what that was. I think I was right. A little bit checked out. You can edit that out. Sorry.
What?
I thought it was like
from my amazing
no,
data.
No, I thought I understood that it was something else.
Did you guys hear that?
Yeah, we all heard it. Oscar.
I thought I understood. No, I'm
Oscar
sorry.
Wants
Next time
a goose
I'll pick a history renaissance.
He's not listening to
Bad
anything.
To women.
No, I thought I was listening, but I misunderstood. Forget it. I thought it was like a like something you could buy. Forget it.
Yeah, okay. Six geese.
Yeah, that's
like
too
actual,
many.
I misunderstood.
Aren't they pretty aggressive as well? I don't want six. Six one's enough to have to, you know, avoid. But six in my house, that can carnage. All right.
A goose is the last thing I want.
Yeah. Yeah, they're the last, absolutely last thing.
The turtle doves. Two turtle doves. $450.
$450 for $2. I feel like we're at market now. Two turtle doves for $450 going once. all right. I've got two for you real quick. One is the accumulation of human-made mass on Earth. So if you picture a set of scales, on one end you have things people have made from 1900 to 2020, so 120 years, which is most of the stuff humans have made ever. On the other end of the scales, you have the weight of life on Earth, so plants, animals, things like that. Last year, the amount of human-made mass outweighed the amount of biomass, according to Visual Capitalist. Can you guys think what accounts for half of the weight of everything we make?
Yes, carbon footprint. I'm just joking. No. Paper.
Paper?
Yeah.
That's the least heavy. It's concrete.
Wow.
But isn't there that thing about like how a feather weighs more than concrete? Remember how when we were kids there was that?
It's like 1,000. Yeah, it's like 1,000 pounds of concrete or 1,000 pounds of worth of feathers. And you say feathers.
And they're the exact
they're
same.
The same.
It's still 1,000 pounds.
Right?
Yeah. This wasn't a trick question, Susie. But concrete accounts for about half the weight of everything we've made, since it's the most frequently used building material and is actually the second most used substance in the world after water.
I was going to say that.
Oh,
yeah.
Were you?
I should have.
After last round, I was afraid of getting called out.
Yeah, after last round, gosh, I'm like misunderstanding all of this. Okay, go ahead.
Although small compared to other materials, the mass of plastic we've made is greater than the overall mass of land and sea-based animals combined. I think it's double, actually. I think the amount of plastic we've made weighs more than all the animals in the land and in the sea combined, which is terrifying. At this rate, the amount of human-made mass will almost triple the amount of global living mass by 2040. Making too much stuff and putting it on top of what was already here.
New York City is a good example.
We're the worst. Yeah, New York City is responsible for about 90% of that.
Have you seen the commercial for the Milk Association, how they're trying to, because apparently cows have a really big carbon footprint. So now the commercial for, remember when we were kids, it was like the Got Milk commercial?
Yes.
Now it's all about the carbon footprint of the cow and how it's not as big as we think it is.
Who's this an ad by? The milk people?
Yeah, I think the like Milk Foundation.
Who are these milk people?
The lobby group, whoever the lobby group is.
Oh. Did you guys used to have milk people? We used to have the milkman. And when I say it, people make fun of me, and I'm not that old. It sounds like I was born in 1923, but we used to have a milk float.
Yeah. That's 1930s. Yeah,
when I see, if I see someone's fridge full of glass bottles full of milk, I automatically have so much respect because that is so cool.
They must live on a farm or near a farm, right?
No, we used to, in England, we were growing up, we used to have it. You used to put the old bottles out and the milk float would come past and you'd drop off some milk. I'm honestly not that old, I promise.
With like sparkling water, I've seen that in Spain, but like, I don't know.
Very
I think
fancy.
It's sparkling water, yeah.
Very
that's
fancy
the only, not, not milk though.
Okay. That's one
very
of
fancy.
Us, didn't they, Spain? One more for you. The coldest place on earth is?
Montreal.
New York at the minute. Right. Montreal, no. The coldest on earth, Susie, on earth. The whole of the earth.
Well, I just wanted to shout out to my old home city.
I know you did. Antarctica is the highest, driest, coldest, windiest, and brightest of the seven continents. It is roughly the size of USA and Mexico combined. It is almost completely covered with a layer of ice that averages more than 1 mile in thickness, but is nearly 3 miles in thickness in some places, according to NASA. The number of residents varies from about 1,100 on the whole thing in the harsh Antarctic winter to around 4,400. It's about four times as many in the milder summer months of October to February, plus an additional staff of 1,000 in nearby waters. Antarctica has no indigenous inhabitants, only permanent and summer-only staff at its many research stations. I have no ambition to go. It's too. What do you mean you were right? You didn't say
Antarctica. I said
Antarctica. No, you didn't. What do you mean you said
Antarctica? Totally did. Hey,
did he say it? Did anyone else hear him?
We're recording this.
Did you guys hear him say it?
No.
No.
But I, of course, tuned out when Oscar started talking. In retribution.
Victoria, if you hear Oscar say Antarctica, can we cut it out? We'll cut him out of him saying
listen for it later. I said
she was
it.
Checked out.
He didn't say
totally
it.
Totally said
she's
it.
She's eating a cookie that looks delicious.
Oh, you were genuinely checked out. Can we focus?
Oh my God, I'm so hungry.
Oh, you're looking at Victoria's cookie. Okay.
Her snacks are not in a safe.
Listeners, you're not the only people who are fed up with this episode.
I was thinking the same thing.
Thanks for having us, Marcus.
Checked out.
Have a good
thank
Susie.
You. Thank you so much
Come
for being.
On. All love.
Hello? Can you guys hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, you can hear me. Okay, just talking over me whilst I try and do the outro. Brilliant.
Oh, whoopsie.
That feels good. No, that's fine. We'll just end it. We'll just Irish exit the episode for folks. That is all we have time for. Thank you to my guests for talking over me. Thank you to Oscar.
Thank you for having me, Marcus.
Thank you to Susie.
Thanks for having me, too.
Thank you to Peter. He won this week's Game of the Week.
It was a pleasure, Marcus.
Yeah, it was. Thanks to Victoria. She edits the show and eats cookies, apparently, and has some opinions on Succession. Thanks to everyone listening in. We'll see you guys on Monday for the Behind the Numbers Daily, an eMarketer podcast made possible by Basis Technologies. Happy weekends. What is it with a breakfast taco, Americans? You lose your mind over them. They're okay at best. Bloody helicopter. You've got to be kidding me, New York. This is why I left.
I mean, I'd like my shot at winning. I'm sorry. This is your ploy. This is like your ploy every time.
Okay. Susie's turned into a conspiracy theorist.